film.
Cool. And all right, get ready for your next show.
Thank you. Way to go. You guys are clever, too. I used to feel so devastated. At times I thought we'd never make it. But now we on our way to greatness. And all that ever took was patience. I used to feel so devastated. Getting better each day, stacking that cheddar cheesecake. Look up to the Lord, we pray. Trying to be my best each day until I'm late, the rest of we late. Yeah, to the time being, we lit. Hoping I don't let it get all in my head. I don't need the money just to say that I'm rich. Couple little honeys when they get in my bed. But they used to run for me when I had nothing. Now they wanna fuck cause they see me stunting. Nigga came up off the hustling, living in the lab of lux, and I'm feeling like the man. If you ain't on my chucks, then you wouldn't understand. On me, buy these rubber bands on me, make her wanna dance for me. Probably leave a man for me, standing in the stands, goddamn. She used the front way back. I used to feel so devastated. At times I thought we'd never make it. Now we on our way to greatness. And all I ever took was patience. I used to feel so devastated. Pain in the cadence, turn my brain up a wavelength. Now we flowing and sailing, so just go with the feeling. Baby, soak up the vibe, let's throw some dope up, get high. We gon' blow smoke in the sky till we can open our eyes. Times I thought we'd never make it. Now we on our way to greatness. And all I ever took was patience. I used to feel so devastated. At times I thought we'd never make it. But now we on our way. And all I ever took was patience.
And I think we're live on the air. Take care.
You too.
Thanks a lot. And Chuck Morse here live at WMFO AM 91.5 Medford, Boston, Somerville. As I have returned and delighted to be here at this rather ungodly hour, which is, that's what radio is all about. You know, it's, I think it was once Alex Langer, the, he's like an old legendary radio guy in Boston who told me, I was there for an interview, and he said, you know, radio is a disease, talk radio. You just, you get in it, and it's like it does something. It takes over, I guess. But I think that about describes the situation with me. You're welcome to join the program if you're out there, if you're an early morning person, and I think some tough students are. Or if you're in the community of Medford and Somerville, you're welcome to join me. It's great to be back here in the catbird seat right up here at the great institution of Tufts University, one of America's preeminent institutions of higher learning. What is on your mind this afternoon, huh? Let me just set this up. I should mention that I'm also live on YouTube and that the program is archived. Excuse me. Oh, boy. Sorry about that. Archived on iTunes, Stitcher, and a bunch of other places. Google. It goes under the name of Left Right Radio with Chuck Morse, yours truly. 855-915-9636 is the number. 855-915-9636. What is on your mind this afternoon, huh? Or I should say this ungodly early morning hour would be more accurate. Well, it's been a while since I've been here. The last program I think I did was last August. And this will be my regular slot, I assume, going forward into the next, at least first, if not next semester. And something I could get used to. I don't mind it. You know, I drive Uber. So, in a sense, I can do the show and then get started. And driving Uber is fascinating. It helps me finance my podcast, my column, my books, and all these other activities I'm involved in right now. Plus, it helps me pay for things like my daughter's college education and family expenses. So, I'm delighted and thrilled to have the chance to get out and do some real kind of hands-on work, and that's generally been my career anyway, which I've enjoyed. I'm reluctant to talk, because I do discuss news, and I do discuss issues, and I think we all know what happened in New York City this past Monday, I believe, or Tuesday. There was a terrorist attack, and I'm reluctant to get into it in too much detail here at Tufts because I don't want to have the anti-bias Gestapo come on down on my head, frankly. It's the kind of topic that I can be much more free to discuss during my podcast. And by the way, speaking of which, I should mention that I am in the process of going live every day. It's an experiment on Blog Talk Radio and on YouTube for an hour. And the Blog Talk Radio gives me the chance to give out a phone number so that people can call in. YouTube gives me a chance to reach two audiences, both the Blog Talk and YouTube audience. And once I start promoting it and developing other venues, I'm hoping to develop a free-form online radio community where we can really get down and discuss issues without any concern about overseers trying to censor me or you or anyone else. That's one of the great things about online right now, and I hope it doesn't change. And even there, there are some limitations. I mean, YouTube could take me off the air at a minute, so I understand that, and I respect that. I respect Tufts for exercising what's called in loco parentis. And I do try to stay within those parameters as best I can, even though they're somewhat, you know, vague. I mean, I understand it. You know, a professor here can't just shoot their mouth off and say anything they want. You know, it's a professional situation. Tufts University is a private institution. They have a right to determine, to a certain extent, you know, what is said and what's not said on a campus. I understand that. You know, it's a free speech, fine, but it's not, you know, in a sense, when I'm on the property of Tufts University, when I'm speaking on a radio station that is owned by Tufts, and I'm, in a sense, a spokesperson for Tufts, I understand that there's a certain responsibility that goes with that. I mean, I'd be hypocritical to say otherwise. That's why I'm against, for example, the kneeling at football games. You know, I mean, I don't mind if someone wants to have a political opinion. They have a right to off the team, off the gridiron, so to speak. But when they're on the clock and they're working, and in this case, their work is playing football, they have an obligation to adhere to the standards of their job. You know, you just can't do whatever you want when you're at work, and you can be fired if you try to.
You know, these are things that, you know, where free speech and where freedom sometimes negatively intersects with the right of proprietorship, the right of property, the right of ownership. Tufts University, as I say, is a private institution. So, you know, there's an intersection there and there's a conflict there. And in that conflict, on one hand, I side with the institution. They have a right to decide what goes down on the campus. This campus has a right to decide, for example. And this is where I disagree with some of the civil libertarians and the people like Nadine Strossen, who is the former head of the ACLU, who I just heard speak, where I do think that a campus has a right to decide who comes on the campus to speak. And they have a right to, a certain extent, decide what is said on the campus. And I try to adhere to that, even though those, in the case of like the anti-bias group, you know, it's rather vague, and I would contend skewed. And nevertheless, I do try to adhere to it, and I understand it. Now, having said that, I also think that given the fact that you have institutions of higher learning in particular, there ought to be as wide a berth as possible in terms of free speech without fear. We ought to have a vigorous exchange of ideas. Now, speaking of Nadine Strossen, who spoke, you know, you could see her speech online. I mean, I happen to watch this. She's a brilliant, one of America's most brilliant lawyers, former head of the ACLU, as I mentioned. She was addressing the question of hate speech, which she opposes, and only to the extent under law that it's what's called emergency speech. In other words, hate speech is if you are directly threatening a person or a group of people, or quite frankly, a nation with your speech, then there are limitations. And these limitations have been laid out over many, many decades and even this past century in the Supreme Court and in other courts, particularly by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes when he said you cannot yell fire in a crowded theater. And you cannot call, you know, you cannot threaten, you can't call for violence or sedition. You can't call for the violent overthrow of the government. You can't call for the violence against any group of people, whether it be based on ethnicity or whatever. Nor can you call for violence against an individual. Those are protected. I mean, that's called emergency speech. It's not legal. But beyond that, especially on a campus, I would think that there should be the widest latitude possible for the most diverse opinions, even opinions that we may hate and loathe. Because that's what life is. I mean, you know, colleges are supposed to prepare young people for the world. When you get out of college, you're going to be dealing with all sorts of adverse situations. Something that Strossen mentioned that I thought was interesting on this issue is that you're not going to find speech codes and you're not going to find so-called hate speech at law schools, at least none of the major law schools. Now, I don't know, some really far left law schools, maybe that's different, or far right for that matter. But generally speaking, law schools encourage very vigorous and very diverse opinion because that's part of the preparation for becoming a lawyer. You have to be able to argue on all sides of an issue. I think that high school debate clubs and college debate clubs do this as well, where you learn to argue all sides of an issue. So even though I respect the concept of in loco parentis, and I respect the fact, I respect the institution of private ownership, and that a company, a college, a football team, they have a right to regulate speech and activity to a certain extent while someone is on the clock. And even sometimes when someone's off the clock, because they are, after all, representing the school or the team. So it even does reach into private life. Nevertheless, conflicting with that, and this is perhaps one of the great paradoxes of life, really, is the fact that we want to give the maximum berth and the maximum license to free speech. And I do would argue that that specifically and especially applies to college campuses. So I'll put that out there for you to consider. You certainly are welcome to call in and comment. 855-915-9636 is the number here at Tufts, WMFO 91.5, 855-915-9636. So, I started by mentioning this terrorist attack, and again, I'm going to be very careful in choosing my words here because I do not want, again, to get into any particular ethnic issues, and it's not an ethnic issue as far as I'm concerned anyways. It's not even really a religious, quote, issue. Well, I guess it is, but it has more to do with an ideology. And that is that the ideology of this person that committed these horrendous crimes is something that we ought to understand and study if we want to prevent it from happening in the future. It's like studying anything else. This is what we're supposed to do. You know, if there's an accident, you study what happened so that you can put in, you know, precautions. If there's a plane crash, the federal, you know, the FCC, the federal, you know, transportation, whichever, you know, the oversight group looks at air travel, they study the crash. They look at what happened to that plane. Why did it crash? Was it a design issue? Was it a stress issue? Was the plane too old? You know, were there cracks? And they try to determine what happened, and then they file a report, and they try to make corrections in the future so that there's less accidents. You can never totally eliminate accidents. That's part of existence. But you can take necessary precautions to reduce accidents. The same thing is true in the case of these mass murders, whether it be this terrorist in New York or whether it be the guy in Las Vegas or wherever. Now, it seems to me that it breaks down to several issues. You got insanity, which, you know, I think was the case with the guy who shot up the the theater in Colorado. He didn't seem sane. Or you have the case of ideology. People have embraced an ideology that gives them license to murder people and to commit murder. Well, at least that's how they interpret the ideology. And I think in the case of the New York killer, he was clearly involved with ideologies or an ideology. And we need to understand that so we can confront it and we can call it out. Because if we don't do that and we don't uproot it, frankly, then we are going to be doomed to further attacks. We're going to be weakening ourselves. And I think that it is the incumbent responsibility of any sovereign nation, just like it's the responsibility of any individual, to take steps to make sure that you're safe and that you're secure. That's natural. You know, that's why, you know, you listening to this program right now, I'm willing to bet that your front door is locked, that your car door is locked. Why? Because you want to secure your property. You want to secure your safety. You want to take reasonable steps to do so. And if you live in a tough neighborhood, you might take extra steps. You might put a padlock. You may put even bars on the windows if necessary. You do the necessary things, given the situation by which you live, to ensure your security. It makes sense. It's normal. It's natural. It's appropriate. It's right. And the same thing applies to nations. The nation needs to take steps to ensure the safety and security of the people of its of the nation. I mean, we are the nation. We're self-governing people. So just for the same reason that we take steps to secure our individual security, we expect our representatives who serve a national entity, the nation, to take steps to ensure national security. And in the case of this terrorist, that was not done on two levels. The first level is practical. That is that there were things literally done by our government that put us in danger. I'm going to get into that in a minute. But the second is more philosophical. We have to identify the philosophy, the ideology, without any holds barred, that this person had embraced, because this person murdered us. And therefore, by doing so in a free speech context, because that's really what's meant by free speech, actually examining corruption, examining evil, not saying the F word, that's not what free speech is. We need to examine it as a way of reducing it. And I think that in a free society, the best way to reduce these things is to expose them. I mean, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, when he fought World War II, he used practical and ideological means to defeat the Nazis and the Japanese. Practically, he sent in the best army in the world, the Allies, and they sacrificed and died to defeat Hitler. But ideologically, he also identified in no uncertain terms, and you can look at his speeches at the time, and they're brilliant. He identified the nature and the evil of Nazism and Imperial Japan. And he contrasted that with our superior system, our free market system, our freedom. And he called them out, and he pointed out, and he made no bones about it. Both of these fronts, the physical and the spiritual, if you will, were a two-pronged attack on Hitler and led to his collapse and defeat, thank God. I would say the same thing was true in the American Civil War. Lincoln and General Ulysses Grant, they called out, they defeated the slaveocracy, and they also called them out and said, we're not going to, this is the most evil system ever, and that we will accept nothing but unconditional surrender, which they understood, and that led to their defeat. Ronald Reagan did it in his defeat of the, quote, evil empire. I remember the left was howling with rage when Reagan brought that up, when he called the communist Soviets an evil empire. But it led to their collapse. And that was done without any firing of a shot. There was no war, really. I mean, there was a few proxy wars, certainly. I mean, there was the defeat of the Ortega in Nicaragua, and there was fighting in Afghanistan. But there was no outright war against the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union imploded on its own rot, and that had a lot to do with Reagan and his allies, Margaret Thatcher and the Pope John Paul II and Lech Walesa in Poland and Václav Havel in the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia back then, that they got together and they said, look, your system stinks. It's evil. It's hurting people. It's oppressive. It's creating suffering and poverty and disease, and it's regressive. And our system is superior, the free market system, the Judeo-Christian system, frankly. And the result was that the Russian people woke up and they threw it out, basically. Plus, Reagan tightened the economic screws on them, which helped as well. It's actually a pretty interesting story of what went on behind the scenes there. But either way, I mean, it happened because it didn't just happen by accident. You know, this is how sometimes the post-historians like to portray it. All right, I'm just trying to look at a few public service announcements here, if I can find any. I know that I want to read I should mention that WMFO is doing its annual... Here we go. This annual fundraising to support the station. I believe that you can take part in that by going to the WMFO website at WMFO.org. Let's see, don't drink and drive. This is a good one, actually. And by the way, Uber has done a lot to reduce drinking and driving in this country. If you're under the influence of anything, never even think about getting behind the wheel of a car and driving. People die that way. This is a public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. I would just say to that, that's what Uber is all about. And Uber and Lyft and all the other rideshare companies, they have, in fact, reduced drunk driving. They have. I can speak to this personally. I go out and I drive, you know, sometimes at night. And I'll pick up people who are a little tipsy. Why not? I'm not against that. Yeah, as long as they're not sick. And I'm not encouraging it either, by the way. I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying that if you're an adult and you want an adult beverage, you know, that happens. But if you are going to do it, why drive? Why worry about having a car? Who needs the aggravation and the you know, all of the things connected to it? Uber is not expensive. And if you're going to go out and have a nice time and be with friends and relax and maybe have a drink or two, and I'm not suggesting you do, then Uber is the way to go. And in fact, Uber has cut down on drunk driving. So that's my PSA, if you will. Okay, so WMFO, Chuck Morse, every Thursday morning at 4 a.m. Well, 3 a.m. I don't even know what time. It's 4 a.m., isn't it? Yeah, 4 a.m. Thank you. I'll be all right. And we're live at WMFO. We're live on YouTube. And also the show is archived on iTunes and Stitcher. You're welcome to check it out anytime. I think that as the weeks move in, as we move on in the weeks, I will be promoting that on campus so that I've been told by some people here that I do have some following on this campus, apparently. So I want people to know about the show and have access to it. And then they don't have to wake up in the middle of the night to listen live. I mean, so they can check it out on iTunes and Stitcher and Google and hear it anytime they want in the day. So, by the way, those are great services. I mean, I've got an archive on those services that of probably at least 500 shows that I've done in various settings and at various stations. So, I mean, it's quite a thing. I mean, and plus my column is available at Newsmax. And my books are available at Amazon. I'm not trying to plug anything here. I'm just mentioning it. It's out there if you'd like to see it. So, getting back to the topic at hand here, we have to understand the nature of what happened. I think that in the late 1990s, we saw this whole spate of shootings at schools, at high schools in particular. You know, I'm thinking of Columbine. And I think that there was a consensus that one of the main drives for that was drugs. You know, these prescription psych drugs. And that is just simply an examination of what happened and of the similarities. And I believe it was found that the overwhelming number of people who were involved in those shootings were on some kind of a psych drug, you know, whatever it was, Valium, whatever they want, whatever the name is. And if you look at the fine print in those drugs, and that's something that I recommend that everyone does if they are on a prescription. And I'm not against prescriptions. I'm on a prescription, frankly, you know, for high blood pressure. It's a very small prescription. I don't take it every day. But so I'm not against drugs at all. I mean, I think that they have a place. But there are side effects, and you need to understand those side effects. You need to read the fine print when you take a drug. And in the case of psych drugs, the fine print says that they could lead to homicide or suicide. Now, that's just a fact. I mean, you can examine, you know, statistics on that. And if you're a younger person, if you're like under the age of 20, and the younger you are, the more vulnerable you are to the effects of these drugs. You know, just like the more vulnerable you are to the effects of alcohol. you know, I'm old enough that I can have a drink or two and it doesn't affect me because I'm developed. I'm fully adult. But for an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old or even a 21 or 22-year-old person, they are not physically fully developed yet. They may think they are, but they're not. And not to mention psychologically, they're not fully developed yet. That takes probably up until maybe, I don't know, some cases maybe mid-20s. Used to be younger, by the way. And as such, these drugs can have a much more serious and profound effect on them than it would be for someone who's older. So I'm not suggesting not to take them. I'm suggesting to do so as an informed consumer. And in the case of these shootings, these people were all on them, and they were all dealing with some of the side effects of them. They probably were vulnerable personalities anyways, or they had a propensity to act out under these drugs. I mean, some people, for example, with alcohol, they might have a little bit more of a propensity for alcoholism than other people. I mean, there are some theories that say that's genetic, and there are some theories that say it's behavioral. It doesn't matter. The point is that some people have that. So, you know, if you think you may have a tendency in that way, you have to be extra careful. But in the case of the killer with the car in New York, this is ideological. This is something that's happening all over the world. These are people who have embraced the same ideology. They go by various names. I'm not going to mention those names. People know what they are. This is Tufts University, so I can't. But the point is that they've embraced an ideology and, quite frankly, a religion that, when viewed in its purest form, I would argue, gives sanction to murder, gives sanction to killing in the name of it. It calls for world order, calls for world conquest. And when I say world conquest, I don't mean it in the Western sense, the Judeo-Christian sense, which is a personal relationship with God through Christ. That's a voluntary thing. That's a private thing. Christianity is not supposed to be enforced. Now, I'm not suggesting it hasn't been in history. It has. But those are aberrations of the faith. Those are mistakes. Those are exceptions. And those weren't as common as you think. But the faith of the people who are doing these murders, they believe that they are commanded to literally, physically conquer the world. And therefore, they feel commanded to fight a war to subdue the part of the world that has not submitted to their will. Now, that's not unique to them. That was the ideology of Hitler. That was a political faith. That was the ideology of the communist movement, frankly, of Stalin, of Karl Marx. You know, this idea that in order to create a utopian world, which is something that we don't want in the West, because we know that that's not human, it's not natural, there's no such thing, and it can never be, that it was okay to do all sorts of things. It was certainly okay to lie, but it was furthermore, at times, okay to use violence. Violence is a part of it. It condones violence. It actually calls for violence. The red in the communist flag stands for the blood that'll have to be shed in order to give birth pangs for their revolution. So they believe in violence. So I'm not saying this as an attack on any particular faith, because I think it is an ideological aspect of many faiths, whether they be based on a belief in a supernatural or spiritual side of life, or whether it be atheist, like communism and Nazism were. I'm simply saying that this is a faith that condones and sanctions the right, allegedly, which it's not a right, but the believed right, the assumed right, of one group to impose its will on another. I mean, that's what communism was. It was calling for world order under a revolution. That's what Nazism was. That was the Blitzkrieg. And that's what we're looking at today. Now, I am not at all suggesting that everyone who's involved in that faith at some level embraces that aspect of it. Thank God most of them don't. I would say probably 90% of them don't, maybe even more. I don't know. But that does not take away the fact that that is there. It is part of it. And if they want to believe that they have a right to impose their will on me, and that they're engaged in a war against me because I don't submit to their beliefs, I suppose in the literal sense, they have a right to that belief, but they do not have the right to carry it out. And that's what they're trying to do. And that's what this guy in New York was trying to do when he decided to run down innocent people on the sidewalk and kill them. And that is what we need to come to terms with. That is what we need to call out. And we need to do it without all this pussyfooting around. I was listening the next morning to MSNBC and the show, Morning Joe Scarborough. And it was the usual pablum. I have to hear from Mike Barnicle saying something like, New York woke up this morning. People were walking. People were breathing. People were living their lives. People were putting this thing behind them. That's a lot of BS. First of all, there were eight people who were not walking around. They were not breathing. They were not living because they'd been murdered. And this is not something that we put behind us. This is what's in front of us. This is what's going to happen more unless we take an honest look and we stop with this poetry and this insane prattling, and we take a hard look at exactly what this is. We have to understand it. We have to identify it in order to stop it. Not sit around with these stupid slogans. Then, of course, Mika, she tries to twist it and imply that President Trump is responsible for this, when it's quite the opposite, actually. Now, I was going to address, I think I've tried to address in so many words because, again, this is Tufts University and I can't get specific. So I've tried to skirt around the edges and address the philosophical issues around what happened, what this person embraced philosophically that led him to feel that he could go out and murder people. And then, by the way, sit in his hospital bed and brag about it. And say that he felt he was proud of it. Really proud? Proud to kill innocent people? That's something to be proud of? Whatever. I mean, I think that everybody's going to agree with me that it's despicable and evil. So I've gotten around that. I'm not going to go any further with it, but I want to talk about some of the practical things that led to this. There were three issues I'm going to bring up. The first issue is that it's my understanding that when 9/11 took place, the mayor of New York, Rudolph Giuliani, responded by setting up a task force in the New York Police Department that was charged with investigating and developing an intelligence network that would try to find potential terrorists. People that would inform. And they were doing an incredible job, a brilliant job, by all accounts. They worked outside of the city of New York. They worked in the tri-state area, of course, in New Jersey as well, and Connecticut, and just the surrounding area. And they also had interface with the FBI, and they shared information regarding any potential threat. And they did an incredible job. Mayor Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg, carried on with it for his entire time as mayor. Then when de Blasio took office, one of the first things he did was abolish this, and did it with, he thought it was a great joy. Oh, we're going to get rid of this. Why? Well, I mean, I suppose that there was some vague language about that we don't want to, quote, profile and that kind of thing, which is, you know, it's doesn't make any sense. It's like, of course you profile crime. You know, when you're going after the mob, you know, here in Boston, one of the reasons why, and there's a good book about this and how they took down Jerry Angiulo and the mobsters. When you went after Whitey Bulger and his gang, of course you profile. You do whatever you have to do to investigate these things and to find out who they're dealing with and who's linked to them for any reason. You don't have to apologize for that. You have to keep people safe. And they could do it in a way that doesn't affect anyone's civil liberties. I mean, in the case of Angiulo, they actually got warrants from a judge sealed, this judge, Diane Kottmeyer, a very good judge, by the way, who they would go to her in private behind closed doors and present evidence that someone needed to be bugged and investigated. And she'd give them permission if they brought the evidence, and they would do the bugging and they were investigating. And eventually they took the whole thing down. You know, that's good police work. That's good detective work. Of course you do that. You don't get rid of that. Well, de Blasio thought it was not politically correct, and insanely he got rid of it. So now New York is vulnerable. The second issue is the so-called lottery that was put forth by Charles Schumer of New York and other senators, not just him. It's not even this isn't a partisan thing. I think there were several Republicans who were part of that too, including what's his face from Florida, Marco Rubio, which basically said that rather than vetting immigrants to this country and taking a look at their background and whether they might have terrorist connections or whatnot, or whether they're coming from a country that harbors terrorists, instead there would be a lottery that they would try to encourage immigration from certain countries that were unrepresented, and that people could just sign up for this lottery, and if their name came up, they'd be given visas. They'd be given immigration status. And one of the countries on that lottery list was Uzbekistan, which is where this terrorist came from. And there has been an upsurge of terrorists coming out of that region of Central Asia, which is really, by the way, too bad, because that's always been historically a moderate region. But apparently terrorism and radicalism is taking hold there. And what that means is you've got people like this guy, this piece of filth from New York who killed innocent people. Excuse me for that. I hope I don't get in trouble with the anti-bias people for that. If I do, I guess, well, I'll stand by it, but I'm sorry. Anyway, getting back here, the lottery did not properly vet people. Instead, it just took people based upon their nationality and said, we need this number of this group and this number of that group. And that you know, this is the second piece here that it just doesn't make sense. It's not rational. It's, I don't know, is it political correctness run amok? It's social engineering. It's nation building. It's whatever. You can call it a bunch of things. But it's illogical. It would be like you're having a lottery to decide who comes into your home. You know, you decide based upon your own, you know, your own judgment on that person and what you want. You don't even, you know, you have the right to decide who comes into your home. You don't have people draw straws and say, whoever draws these straws gets to come in. It's insane. So that's the second piece. And the third piece, and this one goes back a ways, and this is one I actually have some direct experience with. That is the what's called the Frank Amendment. In 1986, around that time, President Ronald Reagan was appraised of the fact that there was a growing threat by radical Palestinian groups in California in particular. That was this group PFLP, which is, by the way, radical leftist group. They weren't particularly Muslim or any other religion. They were more into radical. They were working with the Soviets, probably. I mean, who knows? But they were recruiting. They were raising money for their so-called charities, which were, they were shipping in some cases overseas. They were engaging in propaganda. They were writing, you know, sending out flyers promoting various causes that could be described, frankly, as anti-Semitic and anti-American, certainly anti-Israel. And they were not citizens, right? Now, if they were American citizens, then they'd get protection as such. But they were visitors to this country. And Reagan set up this agency called the ABCC that would investigate their status in this country and find out if their visas had expired or where they were, if they could be not renewed. And in the case of several of these people, it turns out that their visas were not valid. They were detained and they were deported, I believe. Or they were awaiting deportation. Well, into the breach comes Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, who says, this is discriminatory. You can't do this. And furthermore, this new agency, the ABCC, was supposed to coordinate efforts between various government agencies, the CIA, the FBI, and other investigatory agencies, so that they all could be sharing information, they could be on the same page. Frank thought that was bad. He said, you have to stop that. Each agency has to do their own work. It doesn't matter if it's duplicates. You can't have that thorough an investigation of these sorts of crimes or these sorts of activities. So he challenged that as well. And he did it under the guise of civil liberties. Now, it also turns out that at that time, Barney Frank, and by the way, I'm speaking here as somebody who has debated Barney Frank in person. I ran against him for Congress in 2004. I investigated this. I confronted him on it on a stage in a debate. I sent letters to the head of the Homeland Security Committee in Congress, suggesting that he be removed from that committee because he was a danger. And he was removed after I lost the election, very quietly. I think that my letters had everything to do with that. But the point is that back in the 1980s, he was able to get this agency disbanded. He was able to get, you know, the FBI and the other agencies were no longer able to speak to each other. And by the way, this directly led to 9/11. According to the 9/11 report, by the way. But furthermore, he actually got legislation passed through Congress by making compromises, and it was signed into law by George H.W. Bush that amended the Immigration and Nationality Act so as to prevent the denial of visas to people unless there was proof that they had been involved in, quote, terrorist activities, unquote. Now, Frank, according to his own comments and his own writings, he was also motivated by the fact that Cuban communist poet and author Gabriel Garcia Marquez was on a list of people who was not allowed into the country because of his friendship with Fidel Castro. And Frank thought this was unfair, this was discriminatory. He made very sarcastic articles that were posted on his congressional website, articles that he subsequently took off once I brought them up. He scrubbed, saying, you know, insulting, like, oh, well, we have to protect American ears from ideas and subversive comments. And, oh, we're also sensitive. We can't do this. First of all, Marquez could speak anywhere. He could speak on his ideas all he wants outside the country. I mean, especially with the internet being what it is. I mean, it didn't mean he has to actually come here. So Frank got this bill passed, the Frank Amendment, the first Frank Amendment. There ends up to be over 13 of them over the 90s that would allow Garcia Marquez to come into this country. But the problem is that, and so he could go to colleges and, you know, make a ton of money talking, you know, criticizing the United States, talking about how wonderful Castro is, and take his satchel of cash and go home. You know, I mean, I don't mean to be sarcastic there, but that's what he did. But the fact is that according to Bill Clinton's FBI, CIA director, Woolsey, the Frank Amendment, whether intended or not, and I don't think it was intended. I don't think Barney Frank said, oh, good, let's open the country up to terrorists. But the sum effect of it was that it opened the floodgate to terrorists. Because you can't prove, it's very difficult to prove that someone's involved in, quote, terrorist activities. You couldn't have proved that bin Laden was involved in terrorist activities. It's very difficult. You know, he probably could have come in this country with a visa after the Frank Amendment. I mean, maybe even did, I don't know. But the point is that it raised the bar so high in terms of preventing people from coming into this country that they started coming into this country. And they started recruiting while they were here. And they started spreading their propaganda and their poison. And they started raising money, which they were sending over to seas to end up in the coffers of groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda. And there was very little that our security agencies could do about it, because after all, there was no proof that they were involved in, quote, terrorist activities. So they came in, and eventually they flew airplanes into the World Trade Center on 9/11. They were all here on those visas that were made available thanks to the Frank Amendment. Barney Frank might as well have been flying those planes, frankly. And the whole thing was, so these are the three things that have corrupted our system that need explaining, because they are, you know, they all, you know, the de Blasio getting rid of the agency to investigate terror, Schumer and these other senators with their lottery, and Barney Frank with his Frank Amendments. All of these things were meant to expedite the ability of terrorists and anti-American people, in some cases, why not let in Nazis and white supremacists while they're at it? You know, people who held views that are antithetical to American, to come into this country and do whatever they want, short of, as long as it's within the color of the law. I mean, the 19 hijackers, they didn't break any laws while they were here, right? They probably didn't even get a parking ticket. I mean, they operated within the color of the law until the day they hijacked those planes. And this gets into a more fundamental philosophical question, which is the premise that somehow a government, in this case our government, but it could be any government today or in history, is engaging in some kind of a discrimination by determining who gets to come into their country. Of course we discriminate when we decide who comes into the country. That's what immigration is. You can come in and you can't. There is just like the country is operating as a macrocosm of the family or the individual. You as an individual living in an apartment or a home, you get to decide who enters your home. You get to decide who enters your car. You decide, and there are laws that protect that right. You know, it's called breaking and entering. It's called loitering. It's called trespassing. Well, the national government operates in the same way. They have the right, in fact, they have the responsibility, the moral responsibility, to decide who enters the national home for whatever reason. And they don't need to explain that. That is just a function of national sovereignty. We have the right to determine as a free people, a self-governing people, through our representatives in Congress, through our president, to determine who enters the national home and who doesn't, for whatever reason we choose. It's that simple. Yes, it's discriminating. But that's what it is. I mean, I would suggest that it should not be decided based on race. you know, I would have welcomed people, you know, frankly. I mean, I tend to be liberal on this issue. I mean, I think that we need to have immigrants come in. You know, for example, I mean, Haitian immigrants are among the greatest immigrant group we've had in modern times. Vietnamese immigrants are tremendous immigrants. It's nothing to do with their race. They want to come here. They want to work. They want to contribute. You know, people from the countries that President Trump has banned, by the way, they can come here if they have a sponsor, if they're a professor, if they have a reason to come here and contribute. You know, people don't realize that. It's not a complete ban. It's simply saying that you have to, you know, you have to apply, you have to get a sponsor, you have to get maybe a congressman, or you have to get a business to vouch for you. That's the old system. And then the State Department might have a say in it, but they'll probably give a pass. I mean, in the case of Barney Frank, the State Department would have given him permission to let in Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He was harmless. And he would have come in here and sold his books. But instead of doing it that way, Barney Frank had to pass a law letting everybody in. So we have 9/11, and we have this guy in New York now. I guess the point I'm making, and we're reaching toward the end of the program here for today, I'll be back, God willing, next week at 4 a.m., is that it is this natural right of any sovereign nation, just like it's the natural right of any individual, to decide who comes into the national home for any reason. It is codified in international law and custom. This is not something I'm making up. It is a right that is inherent in nature. Animals understand this right. The beaver understands it. You don't enter a beaver's dam unless the beaver gives you permission. You don't go into a bird's nest unless the bird gives you permission. And if you try to go in, you're going to get bitten. I mean, this is something that is hardwired into existence. Boundaries. You understand, you set up your turf. I mean, every animal down to the amoeba does this. It's survival, frankly. It's natural, and it's appropriate, and it's right. And so we set up our nation state to protect our rights as individuals to safety, to function, or for whatever reason. There's nothing wrong with saying we set it up to further our own culture. What about labor? You know, we've had labor unions working for over a century to develop standards of salary and of wage and of conditions and improving the lot of the working man and woman. They have a right to determine things like immigration, because if you have more immigration than the economy can absorb, then that cheapens labor. I mean, labor is a commodity. That's why they say that you have people on the right and the left who favor illegal immigration, because on the right, however that term is defined, and we're going to use conventional definitions right now, you've got big businesses that want to hire cheap labor, and that undermines labor. Labor is a part of our citizenship. They have a right to elect officials to say no. Now, their leadership tends to have the opposite view for reasons that I think are quite bizarre. And I'm speaking here as someone who's been in unions. I support unions. But the fact is that the nation, whether it be for labor, whether it be for industry, whether it be for economy, whether it be for culture, whether it be for security, any nation in the world has a right to decide the nature of who enters the national home. Now, I had some guy tell me, he was a passenger of mine in Uber. He said, well, isn't that a white supremacist idea that we would decide immigration? No, it's not, because Zimbabwe has a right to decide, and that's a black country. You know, the Philippines have a right to decide. Burma has a right to decide. Any sovereign nation has a right to decide these matters. That's what sovereign nations do. It has nothing to do with race, nothing to do with ethnic background. I mean, I suppose if they want to protect a certain race, I guess, and they don't want to have, Zimbabwe doesn't want to have a big influx of white people or something, then sure, they can pass it, they can have immigration. Do I support that? I don't think it's particularly a good idea, but that's what sovereign nations do. They have a right to do it. I support that right. because I want our nation to have that right. I don't think we should base immigration on race. I don't think we do. As I mentioned, some of the finest immigrant groups are not white. It's nothing to do with race.